your work life, your relationships, your money, your health, the meaning of life. Welcome to How to Do Life with Marty Nemko.
Hi, I'm Marty Nemko. Today I want to offer what I'm hoping will be some wisdom about work. And I'm going to start to talk about why maybe work is more important than you may think it is, even though you probably think it's pretty important. It may even be more important than even you think of it is. And then I want to talk about some perhaps non-conventional approaches to choosing a career, then what I think are best practices in landing a job, some thoughts on succeeding on the job, some thoughts, contrarian thoughts, about how to succeed in self-employment, what I call low-risk, high-payoff self-employment. And then I want to describe how I've done these things myself and where they've succeeded and failed, because very often we learn best in context. So I want to start, though, by talking about the power of work. My dad was a Holocaust survivor, and he came here to the United States with not a penny to his name, no money, no English, no family, no education, no nothing, only the scars of the Holocaust tortures. And what healed him was not going to Holocaust remembrances or psychotherapy, if he could even afford it, which he couldn't, but work. He buried himself in work, as did almost all the other Holocaust survivors I knew. The men, the women stayed home, but this was back a long time ago. It healed them because instead of looking backward, they were focusing on what was the next baby step forward. Whether, in case of my father's tiny little clothing store, whether it was how to buy shirts at the best possible price wholesale, how to sell them at a fair price with a fair markup and sell and be a good salesperson. That kept him moving forward and feeling productive, like he was serving the community by selling a good shirt at a fair price and also providing for my mom, my sister, and me. And that really was true of almost all the Holocaust survivors I knew. They really did bury themselves in the work, and they didn't live in the past. My mom used to throw parties all the time. And while they occasionally talked about the Holocaust, it did not dominate their existence. They were able to, plenty of them were laughing and having a good time and having great conversations. I mean, I don't know what goes on behind closed doors, but certainly when they were, with my parents, it was not the sad sack people who had suffered years of Holocaust tortures. So that, in addition to being productive, feels like work deserves more weight than we give it, especially in today's era where all you ever hear the gurus talk about is work-life balance with an emphasis on life. I mean, I am going to be 70 years old in June, and I have worked 60 to 80, maybe 70 hours a week my entire life, and I'm not even close to being burned out. Because as long as I'm doing work I'm reasonably good at and I feel is worthy work, it feels great. And yes, I'm blessed in being self-employed, which is a plus. But even if I was working for a boss, unless it was a crappy boss, in which case I would try to get another job, or unethical work, or too hard work, or too easy work, as long as I was reasonably placed, I would emphasize the work part of work-life balance, because I think it's ultimately, cosmically, I know that sounds a little sanctimonious, cosmically feels better than if I spent, say, hours 40 through 60 in a work week. If I had spent it, video games and TV and shopping and chatting, even the vaunted family time. As long as I have a daughter who's turned out just wonderfully, I believe I gave her quality time, but not huge quantity time. I think my life is better led by spending hours 40 to 60 plus doing my work. And the best example I give of this, I'll give a low-level example and a high-level example. The high-level example is I have a client who's a cardiologist, and he works 60 or so hours a week. And I asked him why, and he says, I'm a damn good cardiologist. And if I don't, those patients who I'm seeing in hours 40 through 60, if they see somebody else, they may not be as cured as if I saw them, or they have to wait longer to see me. It feels cosmic correctness, wisdom. And it's not about money. He has all the money in the world. But it was about making a bigger difference. And if he was really, most people who work long hours are really honest and say it's actually more pleasurable and less stressful to work, as long as you're doing work you're pretty good at, than at home where you may have screaming spouse and screaming kids and, you know, honey-do lists and all the rest of it. So I wanted to make the contrarian case, and that's kind of what I do. If I'm saying this the same old stuff that everybody says, you know, work-life balance, you know, not a human doing, you're a human being. If I did that, it's just same old. There's no reason for you to listen to the show or listen to me. So I like to present contrarian points of view, not for the sake of presenting something that's contrarian, but when there's something I really believe that isn't conventional wisdom, I want to share that with you. Okay. Now I want to turn to some pretty unconventional views about choosing a career. The standard view is that you need to see a career counselor, whether it be at your college or privately, and take tests like the Strong Inventory, Interest Inventory, or the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, and then, you know, do a bunch of informational interviews and interns, job shadowing and internships. And what ends up happening in the real world is that most people don't go through all that. They just kind of give up and they take whatever falls in their lap. I have found that more useful, and even though I'm a career counselor, so what this is, it's the opposite of self-serving for me. It's, you know, because I'm suggesting you need very little career counseling or none, is to simply identify there are six basic core abilities that people have, either one or two that they're particularly good at. Just identify those through self-report. Self-report is often more valid than even those, quote, tests, which show a lot of invalidity often. So those major categories: are you mainly a word person? Are you mainly a people person who does well at persuading? Are you mainly a people person who works well just being as part of a team member, lots of emotional intelligence? Are you somebody who's really good with data, scientific or mathematical data or computer data? Are you more entrepreneurial, not just able to come up with good ideas, but see them through to completion and usually success? Of course, even successful entrepreneurs often have fail, but they kind of know when to hold them and know when to fold them so they can move on to a more promising next venture. Are you more artistic at your core? You don't have to be necessarily the world's greatest freehand painter, but do you have a really good aesthetic sense? Are you talented in the visual or performing arts? Is your just sensibilities artsy, a little bit more gut feeling than rational? That's a core skill. And finally, hands-on. Are you somebody who's just really good at designing objects, seeing things in three-dimensional, or fixing things? Identify the one or two of those core abilities that are yours, and then use that as the filter for the following. There are two great databases of jobs out there. One is the free government handbook called the Occupational Outlook Handbook, which is available just by Googling that, Occupational Outlook Handbook. It's free online. Or my book, Careers for Dummies, which has little short, like this size, two paragraph descriptions of 350 careers, plus a link to for more information on the career. Using either one enables you in an hour or two to very quickly screen lots of careers, not just based on your one or two key abilities, but on just in a holistic gestalt, your overall feeling like, yeah, I could see doing that, or nah, I couldn't see doing that. In just an hour or two, you can then have screened hundreds of careers to identify a few that are worth a little Google search. And then maybe you'll watch a couple of YouTube videos on that career or read a couple of articles on that career. And that simple method is often more valid than the traditional long method, which, as I described, is not only long, but very often less valid. For example, informational interviews are very often highly invalid because you're getting to talk, if you're lucky, with one person in the field, and his or her experience in that field could be idiosyncratic. For example, there are some people who love being a career counselor, others who hate it. Some use one style, others use another. By talking to one person, you're not getting a representative sample of what it's really like to be in that career, let alone for you. So those are some a little bit unconventional thoughts about choosing a career. Now I want to turn to landing a job. The most typical way that people think about landing a job is answering an ad. And that can be the best approach and the worst approach. It's the best approach if, in fact, your background, as evidenced in your resume, is indeed an ideally suited job, ideally suited for the job you're applying for. Remember, today it is so easy for employers to place an ad on their own website, on Indeed, on Craigslist, on LinkedIn, So they often get dozens, if not hundreds, of applications for a job, especially a good job. And so unless your resume is going to be in the top tier, it's usually not worth applying. But if you do apply, you really have to tailor the resume to the job, not just in terms of the highlights at the top of it or summary section, but inserting keywords in context in the resume, because most, especially large employers, initially screen resumes with a computer program that searches for keywords. It also helps to write a good cover letter that explains why you're a good fit for the job. Now, a lot of people tell me, oh, but you can't send a cover letter because you have an online application and all you can do is upload your resume. Well, you can. All you need to do is append the cover letter directly to the resume that you're uploading. Similarly, there's a piece that you can append to the resume that can often be very helpful, and that is what I call a white paper. It's a 2 to 3 page paper that shows your current knowledge in the field. So if, let's say, you're trying to become a fundraiser, writing a 2 or 3 page paper that distills the wisdom of the best research you could find on the internet or your own experience, saying there's something like 7 keys to successful fundraising in 2020 is a very good thing to add and to append to your resume. In the for-profit sector, for example, let's say you're looking for a job in biotech marketing. You can still do the same thing. 5 keys to successful biotech marketing, you know, medical device or biotech marketing in 2020. It's like icing on the cake. If your background is not really well suited, that collateral material, that white paper won't help. But if you are well suited, that can push you over the hump and get you to the interview. Now, let's say you're not perfectly suited for jobs. You've got to use one or more of the 3 types of networking. The first type is using your existing network, but doing it in a systematic way. Make a list of 20, 30, 50 people who you like. No, they don't have to be in a position to hire you, but everybody knows somebody or knows people. You contact them, whether by email, text, phone, or an offer to get together. And after making sure you have established enough rapport and not just making them feel used, you ask them if they might know somebody who might be in a position to hire you. If they say no, you say, I understand. Would you mind keeping your ears open? And if I'm still looking in a month, would you mind if I circle back? Nearly everyone would say that. And now you've recruited a bunch of scouts who are looking for you. That's one method of networking. That's your existing network. The second is to expand your network. And the best way to expand your network is with ongoing meetings with people. That means, and how do you get to do that? Here are some ways. You volunteer for an organization. You try to get on a board of directors. You take a class that meets multiple times in your area of professional interest. You get involved in your professional association, for example, on the program committee is often the best way to do it, even if it's just for your local chapter. Because you're not only going to meet with the people on the program committee a bunch of times, but you're maybe reaching out to heavy hitters to try to get them to speak at your conference. Therefore, you're also having a great networking opportunity there. So that's the second approach to networking, which is to expand your network by having ongoing interactions. Also, I might say, sometimes there are people who have the gift of networking just on the fly, whether they're in line at a Trader Joe's line, or they are on a subway train, just walking down the street. They start up conversations. So that's also part of that way of expanding your network. Church also, for many people, is a potent bond and a way to expand your network. The third is direct contact. And there was a study done by the 5 O'Clock Club, a nationwide chain of career counselors, that found that this actually is the most potent way to land a job if you'll use it. What that involves is identifying, say, 10 or 20 organizations in your target field and identifying somebody to contact with there using either LinkedIn search function or the website of the organization or a Google search to find the name of somebody. Not to be the perfect person to hire you, but somebody potentially with the power to hire you. And you reach out to them using what's called email call. You call them after hours and you give a 15 or 30 second little pitch, your quote elevator pitch, that says something like this. Hi, I have just completed a 5-year project in which I brought healthy fast food restaurants to six Central European countries. And I'm now looking for my next project. I'm wondering if it might make sense for us to talk to see if I might be able to be of help to you, or even for some advice as to where I should turn. I'm going to email you this in writing as well as send you my resume and perhaps that two or three page white paper. And I would welcome hearing from you. You hang up and you immediately send that email. And then in 3 days, if you haven't heard from him or her, you make a call. And again, nobody these days who has any power tends to pick up the phone. So you're leaving a voicemail and you're going to say again, "Hi, I'm Joe Blow. I'm the person who was bringing healthy fast food to Central European countries. I thought it might make sense for us to talk to see how I might be able to be of help to you. But you haven't responded, so I'm assuming you're not interested. But I know how things can fall between the cracks. So I figured I would take the liberty of calling to follow up. If you think we should talk to see if I could be of help to you or even for some advice as to where I should turn, I'd love to hear from you. If not, I promise I won't bother you again. I don't want to be a pest. Here's my phone number." And that is a really good third way to use networking, which is direct contact to target employers. But do expect to get rejected a lot. Or ignored most of the time. Today's rejection typically is being ignored rather than a rejection letter. That's just the way of the game. It's been said that the job search is no, 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 maybe, no, 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 maybe, no, no, contact me in 2 months, no, 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 maybe, yes. So keep that in mind. You know, of course, if after, 2 months of trying, you're getting nowhere, then you do have to know when to hold them and know when to fold them, or more literally, as Ralph Waldo Emerson said, a foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds, or shrinks would say, definition of insanity is doing something the same way 500 times and expecting a different result, on number 501. So, when I come back, I am going to share with you ideas about succeeding on the job, some contrarian ideas about low-risk, high-payoff self-employment, and then how I've tried to use these and other principles in landing a job successfully and not.
You're listening to How to Do Life with Marty Nemko. You can email Dr. Marty Nemko with your comments and questions at mnemko@comcast.net. Or for his articles and books, visit martynemko.com. That's MartyNemko.com. Now back to How to Do Life.
Thanks for staying with me. I'm Marty Nemko. Now I want to talk to you about succeeding on the job. Maybe the first thing I want to talk about is negotiating. Maybe the most important thing you can do when you're negotiating is not salary. Because any extra money you negotiate in salary is going to be taxed at your top rate, and your employer gets nothing in exchange for it. I've often found my clients more successful and happy in negotiating other items that can benefit both you without having to pay taxes on it, as well as the employer. And some examples of that include, most importantly, a change in job description to accentuate your strengths and skirt your weaknesses, and explain to the employer how that would benefit the employer as well as you. Another thing might be a training budget. A third might be telecommuting, as the traffic gets ever more choke chain-like. Working at home a day or two a week at least can save you a lot of wear and tear on yourself as well as your car. Another thing you might negotiate is who you report to. You know, let's say you hear somewhere, in the course of in your first day or two there, or even in the course of your interviewing, you really feel that there's a particular boss who you'd love. See if you can angle your way to report to that person, at least indirectly, with a dotted line rather than a direct employee. Those are the kind of things that negotiating can really help. Also, of course, in your onboarding, once you're there, the first few days are critical. Of course, you want to hear what the employer has as expectations for you for the first 30 or 60 or 90 days. And again, as I said, if needed, try to negotiate your job description. You also want to find out some of the unspoken rules that are not going to appear in the employee handbook. So it's usually a wise idea to have one-on-ones, even if it's informally in the break room, or formally with some of the key coworkers, maybe supervisees as well as employers, about those unspoken rules. For example, about lunch. Is it expected you're going to take 30 minutes for lunch, 60, 90, eat at your desk? How much of the communication in the office needs to be done by walking over to the desk? How much by email? There's all kind. They may say we emphasize work-life balance, but in the end they expect you to work 60 hours a week. You need to find out those unspoken rules before it bites you in the butt. The other thing is you need a small win early, or maybe more than one small win early. So, for example, let's say you've written something you think is a good idea. It's very wise to send a draft around for quote feedback, but it also lets people know that you've done a good job. Or in a meeting, don't be the first to speak up, don't dominate the meeting, but let's say a topic is being discussed for 10 minutes and now we're reaching, toward the end of that discussion, that's usually the best time for you to speak up. And especially if you can make a collaborative synthesizing comment, that can be very valuable. For example, in light of what you said, Mary, and what you said, Jose, I'm wondering if it would be a good idea if we did X. That kind of thing can often be very smart and make you seem like a team player, and everybody ends up hearing you do that good thing. That's a great way to get small wins. I want to talk just a little bit about the art of public speaking. Even if you're just giving a 2-minute presentation in a meeting, let alone something larger, it's really helpful to learn how to do some good public speaking. The most important thing I like to suggest here, it's beyond the scope of this to give a long talk about this, but you don't want to over-prepare. The biggest mistake that people make is they script, and then they either try to memorize it or paraphrase it, and they sound too stilted. It leaches the chemistry. I tried to model that here. I made a little outline of what I want to talk about with you, but I scripted nothing, so that you're feeling like you're getting a real human being talking. Even though I've stopped at times, I've said, I've gone back and forth, it wasn't completely coherent. It's better to do that than to be completely coherent but sterile. So yes, prepare a little outline of what you want to say. If you don't have it, can't do that yet, do a little research. Have a few bullet points. Maybe practice it once in front of a mirror, according to a tape recorder, or in front of a friend or loved one. But that's it. And then have maybe your note card, or if you want a PowerPoint, up on the screen. I'm not a big fan of PowerPoint because it takes the attention away from you and onto the screen. You're less likely to have that rapport built than if you're just have your little talking points there. If you want to hand something out that they come away with, send them a one-pager of a cheat sheet or a summary after the fact. That's the world's shortest course in public speaking, but it's a pretty central point. The other thing is, if you're getting a chance to run a meeting, it's particularly important that you keep them crisp. Send an agenda in advance, ask for changes. Try to keep to the agenda as much as you can. If somebody's going off topic or is long-winded, it is not inappropriate to interrupt and say, so you're saying blah, and you synthesize their main point and go call on somebody else. And try to keep to the time. One of the easier ways to keep people from running off at the mouth and trying to impress people is, if possible, schedule your meetings right before lunch or right before leaving time, because people will want to leave right at lunchtime or at the end of the workday. Again, it's beyond the scope of this to talk in great detail about meetings, but that's the world's shortest course in that. I think I want to stop there about succeeding. Now I want to talk a little bit. We only have about 5 minutes left, and I want to talk a little bit about self-employment and a little bit about my successes and failures in using some of these principles to succeed at work. My core belief about self-employment is it's better to replicate than to innovate. When you innovate, you're a guinea pig, and guinea pigs tend to die. The leading edge is too often the bleeding edge. Take an idea that is proven by somebody else and do it in a different geographic area, or either do it more cheaply or a slight variation on it. I happen to know Noah Alper, who was the guy who founded Noah's Bagels. He was far from the first bagel maker, but he learned from the other ones and incorporated that into his first bagel shops in Berkeley, California. And then eventually he did sell out to a major corporation, but he didn't have to start from scratch. Do the same thing. Whatever it is that you're the kind of business you're trying to go into, you don't need to come up with some brilliant new idea. It's very hard to come up with something that new. And if it's that new, it's going to probably either be too expensive to create or it likely will fail. It's usually easier, unless you're really rich and you have a lot of money, it's usually wise to replicate. The other thing, the next thing I really want to say is you've got to be a cheapskate, especially in the beginning. Keep your costs down. Try to avoid renting a storefront. Work from home as much as you can. Avoid hiring as much as you can. If you need help, do it by the hour as much as possible, because the meter is always running when you're hiring somebody full time. And don't spend on sizzle, spend on steak. So fancy logos and fancy addresses and, you know, that's usually not wise. Also avoid storefronts in general because the rent is so huge. So, I think I want to, and again, status is the enemy of contentment there. If you go into a cool field like entertainment or media or the environment or sports or the arts, the competition is huge because a million people want to be in those fields. It's usually smarter to run a business in a small way by picking something under the radar that may be grungy. I know people have made millions in industrial acids, in scrap metal, in mobile home park maintenance. The book The Millionaire Next Door talked about one of the commonalities among those millionaires, those average millionaires, is that they did what are called dull normal businesses. One more example is used truck part brokerage. That's usually a smart way to make your money. And finally, we only have like 2 minutes left or so. So I want to talk a little bit about my where I've made good decisions and bad decisions around work. The best decision I ever made was to not be a musician. I was a very successful pianist from when I was 12 to when I was 22. I played over 2,000 gigs in New York City, made a lot of money. But I would have felt like I was wasting my whatever mental ability I had to be playing Hava Nagila and the Tarantella for the rest of my life. And of course, I'd gain more weight because I loved eating the buffets. What's another thing I did that was good or bad? It was a mistake for me to get all that education. I have a PhD from Berkeley, but for the amount of time and money, and while of course there's some value that comes from having a PhD from Berkeley, it adds credibility. In terms of the amount of learning and the amount of benefit for those 6.5 years and the money was nothing. I got a free ride. It was a fellowship and they paid me. But for all that time, I believe I would have learned more, even though it would be less prestigious if I was learning on my own. What else? Best decision I made for me was to be self-employed, so I was able to control my environment. I like working at home in a nice, quiet, peaceful environment, no boss. I am a self-starter, so I didn't need to have a boss or an infrastructure to help me. So a best decision for me was being self-employed. What else do I want to say? Where else did I succeed at? Something I just couldn't, I've continued to fail at, in a sense. I'm just by nature very intense. And much as I've tried to be calmer, when I do that, there is a loss of authenticity. So I think as you see here, even on this show, I have tried I've opted to be authentic rather than, for example, to try to sound like a radio talk show host, speak more slowly and with emphasis. You know, you may prefer it the other way, but I think it's been a wise choice to emphasize my authenticity. And I think I'll stop there. And so I do want to thank you for listening to How to Do Life here on KSFP. And as I end all my shows, I want to remind you that we, especially here in the Bay Area, where we tend to be a little subject to groupthink, we find comfort among those who agree with us. Growth among those who don't.
For comments on the show or to consult with Marty Nemko, his email address is mnemko@comcast.net.